Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joy Neumeyer. For all the talk in the American media about the Trump campaign's possible collusion with Russia, what's rarely heard is the voices of Russians themselves. Our guest today is Larry Boguslaw, the editor of Russians on Trump, Coverage and Commentary, published by Eastview Press. The book traces how Russian reporters and analysts have written about Trump from the late 90s to today, and compares Russian and American perceptions. Larry, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Joy, for having me on.
So before we get into the meat of the book, I was hoping you could start us off by talking a bit about the Russian media landscape as a whole and what kinds of outlets are featured in your book in particular.
Yes, of course. And my comments on the media come from a particular perspective. My regular job is to work on a team of translators and editors who produce a digest of Russian news pretty much every week. And there are selected publications within that. So I can't claim to represent or to know about the entire Russian media landscape, but I will give a rundown of the sources that we use in the digest and also a slightly expanded version of the ones that are used in the book. So first of all are the official presses, of which we normally, in the weekly digest, which is also published by Eastview, we do not use these directly, although we sometimes use quotes from them. And these would be the Itar Tass Daily, where a lot of official commentary by Putin's spokesman, Peskov, for example, are published. And also the journal International Affairs, which is published in Russian as Международная жизнь, and that's an official organ of the Russian Foreign Ministry. But what we do use in the weekly digest are publications that are pro-government, close to the government, but are not official mouthpieces. But many of the points of view are in line with those of the Kremlin. So those would be Известия, Ведомости, Российская газета, and we also have an article in the Trump book from Russia and Global Affairs, which is a thicker journal that's edited by political analyst Fyodor Lukyanov. And then there are a few middle of the road publications like Kommersant, more business economic coverage. There's the Moscow Times, which is published in English, but it's based in Moscow. And there's Независимая газета, which is one of the first independent newspapers that came out around the fall of the Soviet Union, and is now more of a middle of the road paper. And we also have independent/opposition newspapers that are not supported by the Kremlin, but I would say tolerated by the Kremlin, which would be Novaya Gazeta, which does some wonderful muckraking reporting sometimes, and they have some great commentators like Yulia Latinina. There's the independent RBC Daily, which I think is still run by the Prokhorov family. There's republic.ru, which started out as sloan.ru and changed its name about a year ago. And there's an independent one. The only one not based in Russia is Meduza, which is based in Riga. And we just couldn't resist asking them for permission to put in just one short piece from last year. And notably, the New Times, which is a wonderful publication run by Yevgenia Albats, for various reasons, we could not get permission to use any of their material, which would have been really nice because they have some great interviews in there. And besides that, we have a few sort of what I would call fringe publications, which are most of these actually. Well, there are a range of opinions. One is the Strategic Culture Foundation online journal, which is published in English, and we just smooth out the language, we check their references, etc. And that is very, very pro-government, although it's not an official journal. And in another part of the spectrum is Sovietskaya Rossiya, which represents the sort of old line communist point of view. Sometimes agrees with the Kremlin, sometimes bitterly disagrees. And one that we got permission for, especially for this publication, and they gave their permission right away, is a right-wing newspaper called Zavtra. So that's the rundown.
I think it's just safe to say that it's a more diverse array of viewpoints than most Americans would expect to find in the Russian media, and certainly more diverse than what's presented on state-controlled television.
It definitely is. I mean, most people think that that if you say anything against Putin, you're going to be thrown in jail. But it's really not true. There's a lot of commentary that criticizes him, that makes fun of him, that draws analogies to many historical examples in different countries, and that just that's just part of the discourse.
So when and how does Trump make his first major appearances in the Russian media?
Well, the first appearance that we have is from 1997, where he's making contact with a Russian politician at that time, General Alexander Levit, and so that's the first mention, but it's we wanted to put that in there because Lebedev was later called by the Russian media the Russian Pat Buchanan, and it just so happened that the first time that Trump tried to run for president, which a lot of people don't remember anymore, back in 2000, he was running against the real Pat Buchanan. So we put that article in there too,
mm-hmm.
just to. Put a few dots from the last century to for people to connect. Trump doesn't start appearing even on a yearly basis until the mid 2000s, when he's trying to make various real estate deals in Russia with the people who got rich in the 90s and now have accumulated some influence and property. And he tries to propose building various Trump towers or persuading rich Russians to invest in real estate in the U.S.
How is he portrayed in these early forays into trying to get rich Russians interested in Trump properties?
With a mixture of admiration and skepticism. sometimes within the same article. So yes, he's a crass American, who's just trying to make deals, but on the other hand, he was regarded at the time as kind of a self-made man and the ideal that some Russians could aspire to.
What were some of the other things that he was hawking in addition to real estate?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think he was trying to brand. He was trying to brand a cologne. Yeah, I think besides the cologne, it was just mainly real estate. Proposing to build real estate in various places, from Moscow to Georgia, that is the Central Asian Georgia, the Caucasus, and getting and trying to persuade Russians to buy real estate in America.
Yeah, I think at one point a Trump branded vodka is mentioned that apparently was not very successful on the market.
You read more carefully than I did. Yes,
yeah, well,
you're right.
It's a small historical footnote, to say the least. So to fast forward a little bit beyond the mid-2000s, of course, he makes an appearance in Moscow in fall 2013 to attend the Miss Universe pageant.
Oh, yes.
And I actually happened to be in Moscow at the time. I was working as a reporter, and I saw him walk the red carpet.
Oh, that's right. You were there from 2010 to 2014.
Yes, yes. So I had the pleasure of seeing him in the flesh, and he sat in the front row for the entire course of the pageant. And certainly no one at the time would have predicted that he was 3 years away from becoming the U.S. president. But
who knew?
In your survey of the... Yeah, who could have said? In your survey of the Russian media, what kind of coverage did you find of the Miss Universe pageant?
What we found interesting... most interesting about this, and it was the one of the main reasons we included it, was this was a notable contact between Donald Trump and Aras Agalarov and his son Emin. So there are these negotiations, you know, between Trump and Agalarov to have the Miss Universe pageant presented in Moscow. And for Agalarov, you know, he considered that a great coup, and he had and he said that he had sent his son Emin over to America to meet with Trump, and they invited Trump to Russia, and they were very excited about that.
Yeah, I think he claims at one point that he's going to build a tower in Moscow, and he appears in a music video, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm so glad that we found that one. That's from the Moscow Times. Yeah, after the a few months after the Miss Universe pageant, there's a music video released by Emin Agalarov, and in the there's a scene there where there's a I'm sorry. Emin finds himself in a swimming pool surrounded by Miss Universe contestants in bikinis, and this is a fantasy he has while he's sitting in a boardroom meeting, and Trump seated at the head of the table calls Emin lazy and perennially late, eventually closing with his trademark phrase, "You're fired." Yeah, so we found that article really fun.
Probably still on YouTube if anyone wants to see it, if they dare. All right, so once Trump throws his hat in the ring for the presidential campaign, some commentators, such as the journalist Alexei Kovalyov, have emphasized a pronounced pro-Trump bias in the Russian media, especially on state television. What did you find in your surveying of Russian press treatment of the two major candidates?
There are some articles, you know, we decided to divide articles from that time period, the campaign period 2015 and 2016, into the sort of more emotional personality based articles versus the more analytical articles. There are some articles that are just entertained by the cast of characters, the business tycoon, the television personality, the remark that Trump makes early on in July 2015, where he says that he and Putin would get along very, very well, and some people were, you know, made much of that Trump, you know, finally Putin would have a friend in America. On the other hand, there are some more sober analyses. In fact, you know, as soon as 2015, a couple of analysts, even, even bring, you know, seriously consider the possibility of what would a President Trump look like? What would America look like under President Trump? And there are other articles, of course, you know, for example, by Konstantin Kosachev, who's currently the head of the Federation Council International Affairs Committee, who spends more time criticizing Hillary Clinton than praising Donald Trump. So there's really a lot of viewpoints out there, and certainly Trump was not universally welcomed in the Russian media.
What were some of the reservations that commentators who did take him seriously have?
Well, there is this sense that the whole global order would change, and Russian commentators in general, you know, political analysts like to talk about the world order, the balance of forces in the world. They're very much focused on that issue, and so prospect of a new global order was a hopeful prospect to some, and a scary prospect to others. So the ones that were hopeful, argued that, you know, that finally, you know, America putting itself first and minding its own business would allow Russia to mind its own business in its so-called sphere of interests, which of course includes not only Russia, but the former Soviet Union and parts of the Middle East, etc. So this idea of the liberal messianism of the West and of the US in particular, there were commentators who were truly hopeful that that would come to an end, and that Russia's influence in the world would grow. And the ones who were scared about it thought that this new global order would destroy the stability in the world such as it is, and that Russia would no longer know who it was dealing with. Whereas during some commentators actually look back fondly on the Cold War because at that time they say Russia and America really knew who each other were and where they stood, and some people sensed that bringing Trump into this situation would suddenly destabilize that you wouldn't really know where America would stand.
Did Trump's incendiary statements or personal conduct get much play in the Russian press?
Not really. The American press would be shocked on a daily basis by the insults that Trump would throw left and right. And of course, there was a lot of intermittent coverage in the U.S. about sexual harassment that was, in some cases, quite well documented. There were lots of smart TV commentators would fact check Trump and find out where he had exaggerated or outright lied. And there's very little of that in the Russian press. The things that enraged and distracted and angered the American public were hardly issues at all for the Russian press.
Yeah, they seemed much more concerned with the prospect of him as a geopolitical actor, regardless of what he was doing at home.
Yes, yeah, I would say sooner, well before the election, Russian analysts were looking carefully at what Trump stood for in terms of political stances, economic stances, where the American media, so much of that coverage was just distracted by his flashy personality.
What did Russians think Americans thought about Trump?
Well, some people did have their pulse on what Americans thought, in some way better than better than most Americans did at the time, is they, for example, they recognized that that the rural part of America, the less educated part, the blue collar part, people who felt themselves disenfranchised, sort of, taken along for the ride of globalization, losing jobs to overseas, they recognized that there was a significant portion of the American public that whom Trump appealed to.
I thought it was interesting in one article, I forget who it's by, but there's some discussion of Americans as being brainwashed by Fox News. And it struck me as being not dissimilar to how some Americans write about Russians being hypnotized by state television. but yeah, does it strike you that to some extent people just thought of this, Russian commentators thought of the entire thing as a circus and Americans as not able to make good decisions?
Yes, that was the article you're referring to is by Vasily Gatov, White House and Television, Who Invented Donald Trump? Yes, this was, this was a really interesting article about how Fox was, in his opinion, heavily biased toward Trump.
Was there a consensus on who would win the election?
Not at all. Not at all. Some people were sure that, that Clinton would win it. They felt that that there was a there was the Bushes and the Clintons were sort of dynasties in American politics, and that there's no way that that anybody else could break into that. And others were equally sure, but they saw good reason to think that Trump might win the election, especially as allegations about Clinton's emails surfaced in July of 2016.
All right. So when the not entirely predicted does happen and Trump is elected, in the American media, celebrations of Trump's victory in Russia got a lot of play. In particular, the ultra-nationalist Zhirinovsky's popping of champagne in the Duma.
Yes.
But what were the range of reactions to Trump's election that you observed? Was it universal rejoicing, or were there other elements?
Well, when you if you look at the beginning of the section on that of reactions, you would you might expect that everything will be like this. In fact, I even thought that myself when we were starting to select material for the book. For example, there's a Moscow Times article where there's an election watching party happening in a Moscow bar, and it begins Trump, Trump, Trump. The crowd chanted, raising their whiskey filled glasses. The group of men then turned back to watch the first exit polls from the U.S. presidential election roll in on CNN. It would have been an ordinary scene in Cleveland, Ohio, or Jackson, Mississippi, but this venue was central Moscow, and the bar was filled with Russians, not Americans. And then people who were in that bar are interviewed, and you get some sound bites from them. One of the people in that bar that night was Kirill Benediktov, who was a political analyst, and he wrote a book called Black Swan, a political biography of Trump, and he deliberately rushed ahead to release it just days before the election happened, because he felt very strongly. He was maybe the only one who felt really strongly that that Trump would win, and so that was a real scoop for him to have presciently focused on the rise of Trump. And there's also an article from Zavtra, that right-wing newspaper that I mentioned earlier, that's called "Hey Trump, come on over," that rejoices in how Trump outplayed Hillary Clinton and talking about the America of F. Scott Fitzgerald, Faulkner, Vonnegut, the America of those strong, simple-hearted lads with crew cuts who sat behind the wheels of flying fortresses and bombed Nazi breeding grounds in Europe to the tunes of Glenn Miller. So yes, there's some wonderful hype on that side. And then on the other hand, there's an article by Kirill Martinov in Novaya Gazeta. That's one of the opposition leaning publications, called 4 Years for White Men. Russians are not known for their gender neutrality or equality. I don't know if you've experienced it, being on the ground in Moscow, but Martinov is one of the ones who laments this conservative trend taking over and really seems that given the choice to elect a woman as a national leader for the first time in history, Americans were decided instead to vote for a man, even though he was disliked by so many people. And even more than that, there's an article by Mikhail Fishman, who's the editor in chief of Moscow Times, who writes, "The hope for change in Russia has just been buried in the voting booths of Florida, Michigan, and North Carolina." So some people feel quite dismal about the election of Trump.
Mm. In terms of the fate of Russian politics.
Yes. Because a lot of the articles here are about, well, how will this affect Russia? It often comes around to that. So political circles had begun anticipating a new thaw with the new American election, but in Fishman's view, the new Trump world is going to be a global mess, and this is the sort of reverse side of the coin of the similarities that some commentators picked out early on between Putin and Trump. So the view of Fishman and some others is that now that the sort of maverick is on the stage in America, who's unpredictable, he's belligerent, this mirror of Putin will in a way give Putin permission to do more of the belligerent and repressive things that he has been doing over the last several years.
Yeah, it seems like to a certain extent one's feelings about Trump depend on one's feelings about Putin.
Yes, yeah, that is a good point. And Mark Galeotti writes in the foreword that Trump is sort of a vessel in which a mirror for people's own feelings about their own country, about their leader, Russians' view of Putin and about the world order in general. They sort of project their hopes and aspirations and fantasies onto this figure of Trump. Galeotti actually calls him Protean, in that he can transform in an instant. The range of Trump tweets that will come out in a day or in a week is just it's dizzying, and so he's such a changeable figure that Russians in a way they conjured up their own image of what a world with Trump would look like.
To turn to the question of Russian ties, when does the first coverage of the Trump campaign's contact with Russians or Russia-affiliated figures begin?
That is a good question, and we actually had to go back to some coverage that was not covered in the weekly digests, because We just, the selectors in Moscow and on stateside just didn't realize that it would be relevant at the time. So we went back and translated some new material for this, that is new old material. So June 22nd, 2016, this is something that we did not cover at the time. It just didn't seem that consequential. There's an article called Trump Changes Horses. And this was about Donald Trump during his candidacy firing his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, and hiring this new guy, Paul Manafort, who he calls a conservative and fairly well-regarded political consultant, albeit with a somewhat controversial reputation in local circles. For instance, he was once an advisor to ex-president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. So the figure of Manafort and the fact that he does have these prior ties to Ukraine, not only Yanukovych, but the oligarch Oleg Deripaska, that definitely gets attention and more attention in the Russian press than it did in the American press at the time. And another, there's another more muckraking article from Novaya Gazeta called Republican Party of Regions. And this is a longer, more detailed article that that really looks into Manafort's background and talks about his working for international clients as infamous as guerrilla leader Jonas Savimbi of Angola, President Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire, and President Marcos of the Philippines. So Manafort definitely gets his due of attention during the summer of 2016.
What about the meeting in New York between Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer at Trump Tower?
That was not covered at the time. That one does not come up until coverage in 2017. The lawyer who was involved in that meeting, Visidnitska, was quite adamant that at the time that that she was only there, to consult on a legal case, between her and Bill Browder, a Western millionaire. But we did. We don't have Russian coverage per se of the contradictory nature of Veselnitskaya's statements, but we do have some citations in the back of the book, with the benefit of hindsight that shows up some inconsistency there. And the same goes for Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Where there his contacts with Michael Flynn, who ended up being he was Trump's foreign policy advisor during the campaign and ended up being briefly his national security advisor after he got elected. There's a lot of attention to those contacts too, and there's some official line here from Itar Tass, and then there's a brief interview with Kislyak, where he says that he did nothing out of the ordinary.
What does the coverage of the Democratic National Committee email hacks, perhaps the greatest scandal of all, look like?
The Russian press is not going after. It's definitely not being as alarmist as the American press was at the time and still is. And we're seeing more of the official line that even the opposition publications are not going out of their way to contradict. That is really an interesting case. On the one hand, there is pretty much outright acknowledgement that Russia was behind the hacking, and not just ordinary Russians, but that there were orders from the top. In fact, there's a great article by by Yulia Latinina in Novaya Gazeta, you know, who certainly doesn't, she's very much an independent thinker. And she says that, that curiously these hackers, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, never, how did she put it? They never, their goals were remarkably altruistic in that unlike other hackers, they didn't try to go after economic targets. They didn't try to disrupt, the sales or invoice processing systems of any big companies. They were only going after political targets, and they would always sign on at about 9 in the morning Moscow time and sign off at 5 o'clock, and they would take off all of the holidays that all the official Russian holidays. So commentators knew that the Russian trail was there, but what is so interesting is that not only the official Kremlin spokespeople or the foreign ministry spokespeople, but also rather independent-minded analysts like Vladimir Frolov, who writes often for Republic, said, they said, this kind of espionage has been going on for a long time. It's been going on for decades, even before the technology of the internet existed. There were always spies who were trying to get into the personal business and the personal files of people on the other side, and that it's been going on with Americans infiltrating Russia and Soviets and Russians infiltrating America, that it really is not such a big deal. And that's an interesting perspective, and it's not, and I don't think it's a cynical one either. It's one that's that's founded on historical analysis. So overall, the whole hacking scandal is really the way the Russian press responds to that, and they are mainly responding to coverage that's dug up by the American press. The way they respond to that, it's not a scandal at all on the Russian side, and it's not a scandal for Russian Trump supporters or Russian Trump opponents. Pretty much across the board, it is something that's just seen as, this is what intelligence does.
Overall, would you say that there's a perception in the Russian media that, any of these ties to Russians are significant? Is meddling sort of perceived as a real issue?
Well, it's perceived as an issue in that, it's perceived as an issue in that it affects trust between the two countries. So, for example, in the epilogue of the book, there's an article called "A Generation Raised on Meddling," and this is by Alexander Gabuyev, who's affiliated with the Carnegie Moscow Center. His concern is that, as he says, the U.S. foreign policy elite are currently in the midst of a generational shift. The professionals who grew up during the Cold War are being replaced with new people who are mostly under 50. This new generation started filling mid-level bureaucratic positions, during the Bush and Obama eras. He says that these people don't remember when Russia was a prime concern of America, and he says it doesn't, and so they're unused to it, and they get nervous too easily. He says it doesn't really matter whether Russian intelligence services did meddle in the 2016 presidential campaign, whether it was their goal to put Donald Trump in the White House. What matters is that to the new generation of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, Russia is a foreign power that seriously interfered in the democratic process in their country and help bring to power a person who will destabilize the foundations of the country they love over the next few years. He says that some American diplomats now think that Russia has robbed them of the best part of their lives. So it's not the meddling itself, but the perception of meddling. And so Gabuyev is very concerned that the alarmism that's been peddled in the American press has sort of infected diplomats who should be above that, and that there's going to be a new form of paranoia that dominates Russian-American relations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt quite prophetic to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So to talk a bit about policy, once Trump comes into office, despite reservations about his unpredictability and various other X factors, there seems to be a fair amount of optimism that he'll reduce American commitments abroad and generally be more pragmatic in his approach towards Russia and maybe play ball with Putin. What happens to these fairly optimistic expectations over the course of his first several months in office?
Yeah, that's a great question. The Russians, for example, are very optimistic when Trump talks about how NATO countries in Europe should pay their fair share for common defense. And at one point he calls NATO obsolete. That's early in his presidency. Of course, a few weeks later he takes that back, there have been a number of flip-flops. So overall there's this trajectory, as you said, that starts out with optimism, but then one decision after another starts being made, despite Trump's wishes. America continues to support NATO. America continues to make statements against Russia. Just before Trump's inauguration, the three main American intelligence agencies come out with their hacking report, their intelligence report that said it was either fairly likely or highly likely that Russia meddled in the election, and Trump gets put in this position he's in this double bind now, where if he continues making friendly overtures to Russia, he would be tacitly acknowledging and expressing gratitude for Russia's alleged support of him in the election. On the other hand, if he speaks out against Russia, then he just shows himself to be part of the Washington swamp that he promised to drain. So what we see, going through the spring and the summer, is that one American policy after another starts turning against Russia, and of course this culminates in the August 2017 when the Countering America's Adversaries bill comes out, where Russia is explicitly called an adversary of America, and new sanctions are imposed against it. And on Trump's 194th day in the White House, he signs that bill, which has gotten overwhelming support in both the House and the Senate. So then, before that point, some Russian commentators said, "Well, Trump is speaking out against Russia because that's the only way that he can get along with the Washington establishment. He really is still on our side, but he's got to try so hard to please those globalists and anti-Russianists over there that he's got to do what he has to do." But once that sanctions bill gets signed, that's really a turning point in people's attitudes toward Trump. Even if some people still think that Trump is just kind of enmeshed in the system, they still think that, you know, they still feel very, very disillusioned that instead of this new global order, coming in when Trump is elected, Russian-American relations are still in the same state of distrust and rancor that they were under the Obama administration.
Overall, how would you compare Russian coverage of Trump as president to the American media's coverage of Trump?
Well, the Russian commentator started taking him seriously as a foreign policy actor before the American press did. So the American press, is, you know, especially the liberal press, repeatedly called into question Trump's qualifications and those of his team. He's selecting loose cannons. He's selecting incompetent people. He's selecting people who can't be trusted. He's morally questionable, and his whole team is morally questionable. So there's this subtext of qualifications that the Russian press is not focused on. What they're focused on is, okay, what is he saying? What are the if these policies that he's talking about come to pass, then what's going to happen in the world? What does this mean for us? So they really focus in on policy earlier than American commentators did. In fact, I shortly after the election, I read in the American press, and I can't remember who the writer was, but the commentator said that the big mistake in the whole conduct of the Trump campaign was that his Democratic opponents did not focus on policy, but focused instead on personality, and would rise to the bait of all of these personal jives, you know, lying Hillary, reacting to his bluster rather than saying, okay, Mr. Trump, you know, you say that NATO should pay its fair share. What if they can't pay their fair share? Should NATO troops be rolled back in Eastern Europe and from the Russian border? And these are things that the Russian press was seriously considering, but that sort of dialogue in the American press didn't happen a whole lot.
Yeah, Russians seem much less focused on the question of his character or lack thereof.
Yes, exactly. It's not a question of the issue of moral fiber that Americans have sometimes asked of their president, and Obama was a great example. To have a leader that they could sort of look up to morally and intellectually, that's not an issue in the Russian press. The Russian press, presidency is about electoral support, and it's about political power.
Based on your reading of the Russian media, what would you say is the greatest misconception regarding Russians' attitudes towards Trump or towards America under a Trump presidency?
Let me make sure I'm understanding that question correctly. The greatest misconception that Americans have about Russian perceptions of Trump? Is that what you're asking?
That Americans have, right. Exactly.
I think that unfortunately the whole issue of the Russian meddling has taken such a center stage in the American press's views of Russia that America is really not even thinking anymore about what Russians think. Yeah. So in other words, I don't know if America gives Russians credit for thinking, you know, because the, you know, because the story, you know, the dominant story is that, that, you know, Putin and the Kremlin put, you know, put these hackers, you know, put these hackers up to their work. They, and now it turns out that they sent a handful of Russian spies to, you know, to, you know, to secretly observe what was going on in the, in the, in the election process, and they have these trolls who are putting up, you know, pro-Trump messages and buying Facebook ads, and it's all, it's all orchestrated by the Kremlin, and so there's there's no room for thinking about what ordinary Russians might think about that, or even, you know, even Russian, you know, intellectuals, writers, commentators. Whereas, as you know, I think that the main, the book's main potential contribution to that perception is that yes, Russians do think for themselves, and there is actually quite a variety of opinions about Trump, and those opinions have changed. They've changed radically. You know, from the pre-election time, you know, the campaign, the early months of the presidency, you know, to the present point.
Well, Larry, thank you so much for giving us an overview of the book. We're about out of time, but before we leave you, please tell us what you're working on now.
Well, what I hope will be my next publication is a collection of poetry. I've been translating Russian poetry for some years now, and when I was in graduate school, actually, that was my specialization, was Russian poetry. So, a few years back, I won an international competition of Russian to English poetry, and yes, they a couple of them actually do exist. And through that competition, I met a poet who read some of his work at the award ceremony, and when I heard him read his work, I thought, oh my gosh, that's going to be impossible to translate. And yet I thought, I have to give it a try. You know, so a few months later, I sent him, you know, my attempt at translating this poem. And he said, would you like to translate the whole collection? So I've been working on that, you know, off and on the last few years. And I'm getting, I've drafted translations of all of them. And hopefully, we'll be able to convince a press to publish them.
That's great. And who is the poet?
In English.
Right.
His name is Alexander Weitzman. And he's an emigre from Russia who's quite young, but he's just old enough to remember what life was like in the Soviet Union. And he's extremely well read and has these wonderful he makes these wonderful references to Russian culture, literature, poetry, and it's just a very rich experience to read and to attempt to translate his work.
It sounds like a refreshing contrast to working with mass media.
Yes, it is. It is, but it's all great fun.
Yeah. Right, Larry, thanks so much again for speaking with us today, and to our listeners for joining us for this podcast on New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies.
Thank you, Joy. I'm so grateful that you're doing this podcast.